Psalm 123 is another of those psalms that, whatever primary application it may have had to David, has clearly been under inspiration, rewritten, and is relevant to the exiles. But I think that this is the cry of a faithful individual, or possibly minority, amongst the exiles. Verse 3, "Have mercy on us, Yahweh, have mercy on us, for we have endured much contempt." Verse 4, "Our soul is exceedingly filled with the scoffing of those who are at ease, with the contempt of the proud." Well, what really happened to these exiles? Sure, they began by the rivers of Babylon. There we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion, and those who carried us away captive asked of us a song, and how could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? But the reality was that they very quickly assimilated into Babylonian and later Persian society. So that when Cyrus makes the decree, "Come on, Jews, go back to your land, rebuild your temple, I'll give you the money, the resources that you need," virtually, relatively speaking, virtually none of them went. They all preferred the soft life in Babylon or Persia. The book of Esther gives us quite an insight into the real status of those exiles. They were so wealthy that Haman offered the king a huge amount of money if he were allowed to kill the Jews and to expropriate all their property. Well, they were wealthy, without any question. And there were senior Jews in senior positions. Mordecai is a form of Marduk. Esther, this is literally a star. This is Marduk, this is the star god. So they had assimilated, they had absolutely taken on the values of Persia. Esther contrasts with Daniel, who refused to eat the king's meat and drink the king's wine. She wants to get married to the king, sleeps with him before they get married, is pushed into that position by Mordecai, who's also a Jew. And quite clearly, they have assimilated. And Book of Esther, to my mind, ends rather sadly, that the Jews are wealthy, they are popular, etc. And yet here, we read about how we endure so much contempt and we're scoffed at by those who are at ease with the contempt of the proud, and our soul is so filled with this. Well, Haggai 1 verse 2 says that it was actually the Jews, the exiles themselves, who were at ease and who scoffed at the restoration prophecies as coming true. They said, now is not the time for the Lord's house to be rebuilt. Those who are at ease is a phrase used in Amos 6, again, about the apostate amongst God's people. So, our soul is filled with the scoffing of those who are at ease and with the contempt of the proud. I think this scoffing is not of the Babylonians or the Persians, but of their own brethren. It was them who gave much contempt to the faithful remnant. You see this in Ezekiel. He was there amongst the exiles, and he was terribly beat up by them. So was Jeremiah. He was with the exiles in Egypt, and the same happened to him. Jewish tradition has it that the Jews actually murdered both Jeremiah and Ezekiel. That was how much contempt there was. You look at later chapters of Isaiah, later part of Isaiah is clearly relevant to the exiles, the time of Cyrus, etc. And again, you see there that the faithful are a minority who are being persecuted by their brethren. So, I think then that that is the real sense of this psalm. Not that our we poor Jews are being mocked by the Persians and Babylonians, not at all. They were popular and wealthy, according to the book of Esther. That's why Esther is such a unique insight into the real status of things amongst the exiles. So, what I think you learn here is that so often God's people have been in a minority, even amongst those who bear the name of God's people. As Paul says, they are not all Israel who are of Israel, or who are named Israel, or who literally descended from Israel, as in Jacob. And of course, the question arises, well, are there few that be saved? And Jesus replies to that by not giving an answer, but by saying, strive to enter in yourself at the narrow gate, because a lot of people will seek to enter in and not enter. And this is the way that few find. So on one hand, the seed of Abraham shall be as many as the stars of the sky. There will be a huge number of people saved. But whether we take that literally or whether you say, yes, true, a lot of people saved relative to the wonder of salvation. But then on the other hand, there is this strong teaching that it is a minority who are saved, and even a minority of a minority. That is, there's the world in the majority, and then there's God's people, this tiny group of people, and even amongst them, it is a minority of them. You think of Israel crossing the Red Sea, that's like baptism, and yet the vast majority of them perished in the wilderness. And as soon as you say, that's different, that doesn't quite apply to us. I mean, Paul comes right in on that in 1 Corinthians 10 and says, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Hebrews likewise, take heed lest there be in you an evil heart of unbelief and departing from the living God. This is all very much the theme that you cannot say that we as the Christian church are going to be better than the old Israel. As soon as you say that, you have got to face up to those warnings of Paul not to think like that. Now, of course, this kind of reasoning is much beloved of those with a bunker mentality who like to think that, yes, only seven were saved in the ark, and I'm one of the seven. And, there's only salvation for a minority, and that happens to include me, and the vast majority of you are totally astray. And, you know, this appeals to people of a certain mindset, people of a certain wiring. They seem to like this idea of sort of the heroic minority, and it appeals to them. Whereas, you know, God is a saviour God, and he wants to save many, and many shall be saved. But in terms of percentages, that is a difficult one to answer, and it is left particularly, I think, by Jesus himself in the New Testament, that is left intentionally unanswered. Because our focus must be on our own personal relationship with God. But what I would say is that there is a lot of exemplification in the Bible of where people stand alone from their brethren, where people are a minority amongst the people of God. You think of Daniel refusing to eat the king's meat and drink his wine when he was a young man in captivity, no more than a teenager, I don't suppose. And yet the vast majority of the Jews in exile, of course, did. And you think of Esther actually preparing wine, inviting him to a wine and cheese party. Well, forget the cheese, but you know what I'm saying. She is set up almost intentionally as different to Daniel. You think, of course, above all of the Lord Jesus and the Israel and the people of God of his day. You think of Paul. All those in Asia, or the Christians in Asia, turned away from him. There's a lot of examples of this. Joseph, the one who was separate from his brethren. I think, without going into this business of percentages, that only a tiny percentage of those who are baptized will be saved, but we can't say that. We have to assume that everybody who has made a confession of faith in Jesus Christ and made a confession of commitment to him, you've got to assume that they're going to be saved, because if you assume otherwise, then you are guilty of condemning them. It is not for us to do that. And Paul, therefore, writes very positively to the Corinthians and others who he knew were way off mark, really morally, doctrinally, theologically, way off. But he still writes very positively and hopefully about them, as if he assumes their salvation. Well, that is all you can do. You can just assume that those who are committed to Jesus apparently will be saved. Anything other than that is to condemn them, and we can't do that. But that being so on one hand, on the other hand, I believe that it has to be so in almost every life that I know, folks that I know, my own life, my family. There are times when you do have to stand at times with your back to the world and even with your back to your own brethren and say, look, here is principle, and I will stand for it. And I know that you don't agree, but I truly believe I am right on this point, and we must live in this way. And I cannot accept the way that you're going. Now, by that, I don't mean the normal things that a fuss is made of, that, oh, it's a matter of principle, we cannot tolerate this. I'm not talking about walking out of a church, disfellowshipping people, refusing to break bread with people. No, no, I'm not talking about anything like that. That is not right. I mean that there are just issues over which we have to agree to differ on. Why does God allow that? Well, I think it is part of our maturing process. It is part of the process of our individuation as individuals before God and Jesus. Because we're going to spend eternity in personal relationship with Jesus, which will be a continuation of that personal relationship that we now have. And we shall be given a stone with a name written that only Jesus and ourselves know. It's like they used to do apparently in the first century, take a stone, write a little message on it, split it in half, your friend keeps one half, you keep the other, and only the two of you know what actually is written on that stone. It's a little secret. And that speaks eloquently, I think, really, of our personal relationship with Jesus. And yet many people come to Jesus because their family were believers, because they were in a group of people who believed, they were in a church, and they were sort of on the wagon, and the wagon was going in a certain direction, and they went that way. And that's fair enough. That's how life goes. It's basic sociology. And yet Jesus wants a personal relationship with us. And so I just think in the bigger picture, he allows situations to arise where at times you will stand out of step, shall I say, with your brethren. Now, I don't mean that you stomp off out of the church. Not at all. That is not right. But all the same, you, at least in your heart and in your own personal behavior and positioning on issues, will stand apparently out of step with your brethren. Not because you're difficult, not because you're awkward, but because it's all part of God's bigger plan to help us individuate into individual, personal relationship with him and his son.